Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Anthony Bubalo. I'm the Deputy Director here at the Lowy Institute, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to this In Conversation event this evening on the future of US global policy under the Trump administration. Given the preoccupation of the international media, and in particular the Western media, on the soap opera that seems to have become the Trump administration, we often seem to forget that there's actually a lot happening in the world itself. Every day, there seem to be new examples of Chinese assertiveness or Russian resurgence. The North Korean nuclear program and missile programs are taking flight quite literally. The fight against Islamic State is advancing, but the threat of terrorism is also metastasizing globally. The future of Europe and the global liberal order also seem to be in the balance. And all of these issues make an extremely challenging time for international policymakers. So I'm very glad to be joined this evening by two world-class analysts of US foreign policy and defense policy, who will help us to explore how the Trump administration, and perhaps also how allies, such as Australia, will deal with these challenges. So we're joined tonight by Corey Shaki and Tom Wright. Please join me in welcoming them both. Corey is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and she teaches thinking about war at Stanford, is a contributing editor at The Atlantic. She also writes for War on the Rocks and Foreign Policy. She served in various policy roles, including at the White House for the National Security Council, at the Department of Defense for the Office of the Secretary and Joint Chiefs of Staff, and at the State Department for the Policy Planning Staff. During the 2008 presidential election, she was senior policy advisor on McCain-Palin campaign. That's okay. Things seem to have gotten worse since then. In 2016, she edited the book Warriors and Citizens, American Views of Our Military, with the current US Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis. Tom Wright is well known to us here at the Lowy Institute. In fact, he's a non-resident fellow here and the author of a very popular paper on President Trump's foreign policy outlook, published earlier this year. He's a senior fellow in international order and strategy and director of the Center for the US and Europe at the Brookings Institution. He's also previously, he was executive director of studies at the Chicago Council of Global Affairs, a lecturer at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, and senior researcher for the Princeton Project on National Security. Tom's book, All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power, was published by Yale University Press in May 2017. And in fact, there are some copies here. So there are some copies here available for purchase. So it's great that both of you could join us. It's a real pleasure to host you, and I think we'll have a really, really interesting conversation. We're going to try and tour the world a little bit, looking at the various challenges that are confronting the international community and the US and US foreign policy making. And an obvious place to start, where everything seems to start these days, is China. This week there was an interesting news report about an incident that doesn't seem to have received that much attention, but I think it's quite instructive of where we are with China. So Cambridge University Press, there's a story about Cambridge University Press removing some articles that were sensitive, that were seen as sensitive in China or critical of certain incidents in Chinese history, the Tiananmen Square massacre, things like that. They were removed from some Cambridge University Press journals. And in the subsequent outcry, CUP again allowed access to these articles in China, but it seemed to be a demonstration of yet another example of the way in which China was asserting itself, not just in the big ways that we traditionally think of in terms of the South China Sea or the East China Sea, but in lots of kind of lower level ways. The question I have for you both is, how does even a coherent, well-functioning administration deal with what is clearly now a very multifaceted challenge, one where you have to weigh, obviously, the economic opportunities that China presents, but also some of the security and other challenges that it presents, just not just in as a potential security threat in the future, but also as a threat to the order that the liberal order that has been established after World War II. How can any administration, if they're struggling to deal with Chinese island building in the South China Sea, how can they deal with that and all these other smaller things as well? Corey, perhaps I can start with you.
Yeah, I have two reactions to that. The first is that the easiest way to deal with that is to have an actual strategy, right? Mm-hmm. To prioritize what you think is important. And we too often, in dealing with China, I think the Cambridge example is a terrific one, right? Where Cambridge, which its reputation is based on the quality of its scholarship and its commitment to the free exchange of ideas, they made a craven choice that they wanted access to the Chinese market, and they were willing to compromise intellectual freedom in order to get it. So first of all, that is a major threat that China poses for all of us, because if we don't have a strategy that is true to our own values, we are going to get chipped away right and left and end up in an international order that looks a lot like China's domestic order, which is something none of us want. But it's very, you can always talk yourself into small little compromises in order, if you don't have a strategy that is centered on your own values. The second thing that I love about the Cambridge University Press example is the solution to that problem is they got shamed by all of their existing contributors and all of the existing academics who forced them to recant a stupid policy. And that's the strength and vibrancy of liberal societies. And we too often build strategies that don't trust who we actually are as political societies. And we ought to trust that a lot more, because that's our strength.
Tom?
Firstly, thank you for, it's great to be back. And thank you, Anthony, and to Michael, who I know can't be here this evening, to all the team at Lowy. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I'd like to completely endorse everything Corey said and just add that, you know, I would sort of flip the question around and say, you know, why is China afraid of the liberal order, right? I mean, we often think that this liberal order is pretty benign, right? And that all countries should be in favor of it because it worked for them. But I think that they do actually see it as an existential threat to their regime. And it's not just Cambridge University Press, right? It's, think about a few years back, it was the New York Times that revealed all of the money trail between the Princelings and the Politburo in Beijing, and all of these private bank accounts that the families had. I mean, that posed a much greater threat to the regime in China than anything that the US government does. Mm. And that was the nature of liberalism, right? It was the nature of a free press. And it was the same with other media outlets. And so we saw it with the pressure on the Times, the pressure on Bloomberg, the fact that Yahoo capitulated, Google was in negotiations, Facebook as well, because it's the open nature of our systems that they find threatening. And the notion that they are going to sort of sit back and not do anything about that, I think, is delusional, because they will. And they're going to use all of the force and of the state, all of the power of the state, to try to clamp down on it. And it's going to pose really difficult challenges for all of the organizations and media organizations and educational institutions that we all have that operate in China, because they're being told that if you want to operate here, you have to abide by our rules, which infringe on freedom to some degree. And that, I think, is a huge challenge that we're going to have. And I think that I don't have an answer how to solve that. I mean, we can talk in a minute about overall strategy, but I think one step is to sort of recognize that it's a real problem, you know, and to sort of call it out for what it is. I think the Cambridge one is funny, by the way, because anyone who sort of tried to read a Cambridge University Press journal, like, you'd have paid like $700 to read one article. So the notion that, like, you know, the notion that, you know, that there were all these people in China, like, paying vast amounts of money, I mean, they just called attention to these articles, and someone had a very good solution. They said that they should, if Cambridge University Press bans access to these articles in China, in exchange, they should make them free access for everyone else all around the world, you know, so they don't have to pay the $700 for one piece.
So I want to emphasize one of the very best parts of Tom's very good book is where he explores the way that foreign policies that we in the liberal West think about as neutral, that China in particular views as efforts at regime change. And so we're having an asymmetric conversation where we think these are just the rules of the order. This is a neutral platform for everyone, but that in fact they pose an existential threat to China, and they view it that way.
But not just China, it's Russia.
Russia.
Lots of authoritarian regimes in Central Asia and the Middle East in a similar way.
Yeah, no, I think that what the Chinese are trying to do is advance an alternative model, authoritarian capitalism, right? Centralized political control, a lack of individual liberty, and economic prosperity, right? And that the potential for success of that is where the rules of the liberal order have failed to produce prosperity that could have attractiveness, right? The only people who want that as a political model are authoritarian leaders themselves. But especially after the 2008 financial crisis, that there are questions about the path to prosperity by liberal trade and economics. And that's where the Chinese have the potential to pick up some ground.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right, too, about Russia. I mean, with, you know, we often think about Russia that, you know, the if people try to analyze what was done in the 90s or 2000s, they say with NATO expansion, right? So all these troops are on Russia's border, so they feel threatened. But it's not true, because if you look at the number of troops in Europe, it's fallen massively over the last 20 years, right? It's the military threat to Russia, as it would perceive it, is much smaller than was the case in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s. But what is true is that there are all these democracies on their border, right, because those countries want to be democratic and they want to be free, and Putin is worried that that creates a precedent for Russia. And the thing about all of these things in terms of how China and Russia perceive this threat from the liberal order is that it's a bit of a tragedy, right, because I think that we're actually right to do those things. Like, we shouldn't compromise press freedom just because China doesn't like it, and we shouldn't pull the plug on democracies in the Baltics or in Poland or anywhere else because Moscow doesn't like it. But they're never going to be convinced that it's okay. And so we're sort of destined to clash about this and for as long as those countries are authoritarian. And we need to figure out how to do that in a way that's sort of responsible and you know, contains the damage. But I think we are facing these zones of contestation well beyond the military. I mean, this freedom, I'm really glad you started out with the freedom of the press one, because I think it's one we never pay attention to that much compared to the others, but it's crucially important in terms of how they look at their strategic environment.
So, but what is the role of government in that? As I said, this is, it's an enormous challenge because it's a multifaceted one. It's, you know, we're just kind of coping with dealing with the kind of military question, the kind of FONOPS in the South China Sea. And we don't seem to be coping at all with kind of the freedom of expression issues, freedom of press issues, particularly when it's Western companies who are making these compromises for material gains and who are deeply influential and who it's difficult sometimes to have that kind of conversation with. So, I mean, what is the role for government? You know, I get the point, you need to have a strategy, but I just wonder whether governments are even equipped, even coherent, well-functioning governments, which there seems to be a shortage of, not just in the US, but around the world at the moment, how are they going to cope with that?
So that's interesting. I don't think we're doing half badly at that. Right, which is that I think over the course of the last 4 or 5 American presidential administrations, we actually have had a reasonable strategy for managing China, which is giving them a positive, prosperous, powerful vision of their future if they opt into the existing order, and hedging against the fact that they may not opt into the existing order. And the hedges are military and their alliances. And so what Chinese threatening behavior, like their actions in the South China Sea, serve to do is to tighten the alliance relationships between the United States and Japan and South Korea and Australia, and open up potential alliance relationships with Vietnam and other countries in a way that China rightly perceives as limiting its freedom of action. Not a threat to them, per se, but limiting the freedom of action that they would like to have. Mm. And so it incentivizes them to opt into the existing rules, because one of the great benefits of the liberal order is the agreement by its participants that rules only change by consensus, right? And the Chinese are trying to change rules by simply imposing different rules. And we, the allied countries, are saying, it almost doesn't matter what the rules are. It just matters that we agree on the rules. And so getting the processes right by which the Chinese can opt into a system that, after all, is serving them remarkably well, on rules that make it acceptable to the other countries, particularly in the Asia region, and that give us all a way to give China a positive, successful role for itself in that, and then strengthen ourselves in case they make different choices then. I actually don't think we're doing half bad at that, but Tom, maybe you disagree.
I think a lot more needs to be done, because I think if you look at what China's doing, it does have beyond all of the island building and the pressure in the South China Sea and the pressure on, you know, trying to weaken the U.S. alliance system, they have a larger objective, which is to try to create a spheres of influence system in Asia, where they dominate sort of the western part of the Western Pacific. They weaken that U.S. alliance system, and they have a more China-centric regional order. And if they succeed in that, I think that fundamentally changes not just the Asia-Pacific order, but the global order as a whole, right? Because Asia is obviously a hugely important region, one of the two most important regions in terms of the global order, along with Europe. And so I think that is the goal. And what's happened, unfortunately, and it's not just the fault of the Trump administration, because you saw it a little bit in Hillary Clinton's campaign too, but has been, you know, this sense, particularly on the economic side, of a disengagement and of a skepticism of trade and of TPP and of no sort of alternative vision for what economic engagement with the Asia-Pacific would look like, combined with sort of a piecemeal strategy on countering Chinese revisionism, and sort of a sense that this is the second or third most important sort of strategic issue that the U.S. faces, rather than being sort of a top-tier issue. And so I think that the guts of a good strategy are there, but I think it will require much greater effort. And I think we haven't really seen that much yet in this administration. There's been some signs of it, but it hasn't maybe been as sort of deep and broad in the administration as it could be.
I mean, sorry, go.
No, I was just going to pile on two other points. One is about Western businesses. I live in Silicon Valley, and you know, the tiresome self-importance and sanctimoniousness of Apple and Facebook and everybody else. On the one hand, it's very easily caricatured, right? If any of you have watched the TV show Silicon Valley, it gets the ridiculous self-importance of everybody making the world a better place as their business model. But at the same time, underneath that foolishness, there actually is a lot that's really important. And the tech firms that are really changing the way all of us interact socially are fundamentally liberal organizations, right? So Google wanted very much to be able to do business in China, and the Chinese would only make it possible if they eliminated certain search terms, and Google would have done that, but for the outrage of the posse of existing Western Google users who said, wait a minute, you guys' motto is don't be evil, you're being evil. And so we actually have an enormous amount of control as consumers in these companies, as people who can hold them to the standards they claim to be operating under. And because we have expectations of their behavior, and for them to continue to stand astride our world like Colossians, they actually have to meet those standards. And the second thing I would say is that the business angle is actually really interesting and important, because China has been an enormous success story for 40 years. And the real challenge as a political scientist is that most of us think it's impossible to be sustainably prosperous unless you are politically liberal, right? And China's the big test case. Can they actually get across the middle income trap, get across an extractive and manufacturing economy, and get to the kind of high intellectual content, creative economy, what powers all of us in the West, without becoming representative of their public? It's hard for me to see that they can continue not to respect the will of regular Chinese people and expect that those people will be creative and dynamic and intellectually engaged in ideas, but never want that for their political leadership and never want the ability to hold them accountable.
Isn't there also emerging now the flip side of that problem, which is once liberal societies, economically successful liberal societies, as a result of populist pressures, turning away from liberal ideas? So the other interesting question will be, as some of these societies become less liberal, less democratic, will they be able to sustain that success? Do you also see, you talked about the public pressure, the public keeping companies like Google honest. Against the background of this kind of growing populism that seems to kind of challenge or seems to question liberal ideas, is that something that you worry about kind of going forward in terms of keeping those companies honest, in terms of keeping those liberal principles alive?
Would you like the first bite at this apple,
Margaret? No, you can go.
Okay. So I do think we in the liberal West are in a really trying time. And what makes it so deeply ironic is that in a lot of ways, this is the absolute best time to be alive, right? Child mortality rates are lowest, education rates are highest, the amount of hours people have to work are lower than, like, all these good things, and yet we are profoundly dissatisfied with our own societies. And we're having to work our way through that. But I also think the great advantage of liberal societies, and it's a lot of times, especially as an American in these moments, a lot of times it's hard to see because our politics are so fractious, the process is extraordinarily loud and extraordinarily messy. But what liberal societies are really good at doing is solving our problems. Right? And right now, I think people have a lack of faith in democratic institutions. They have a lack of faith in free markets as arbiters of goods and services. They have a lack of trust in political leadership that's quite astounding and mostly deserved. And we're going to have to find our way through that. But I don't think we should lack confidence that we will find our way through that.
Tom, are you as confident?
Yeah, I think I am. I mean, there is a debate. I think what's sort of unnerving is that there is a debate for the first time in decades on sort of fundamental questions. I mean, if you look back at the debates in the 90s and 2000s, now they appear to be, really sort of on the margins, right? There was arguments over marginal rates of tax or on investment in education, or, the left had become very centrist and the right had become very centrist and the gap in the middle was tiny. And now we're talking about really big things. Should there be a trade war with China? Should the U.S. be isolationist or internationalist? But it's not just America. It's all around the world. There are real fundamental questions about sort of openness versus sort of closed societies. And, I feel confident that at the end of the day, countries will remain open and remain outlooking. But I don't know. I mean, in any... if you look at the average human life expectancy, say 75 years, if you look at any 75-year period in history, really bad things happen in any given 75-year period, and it's often completely irrational, you know, in retrospect. And so I hope we're not about to go through that. I mean, certainly the conditions and circumstances that we have, you know, that if it were to happen, it would probably happen under some sort of conditions like these. And so I hope that we'll muddle through to some extent and have that debate and then come out the right side of it. But I don't think we can take that for granted. I mean, I don't think it's obvious that this is going to resolve itself. I mean, I think we're really, in the U.S., we're like one crisis away, really, from this going completely south, you know, with the Trump administration. Now, hopefully that doesn't happen. I mean, we could totally get through this, but it's, but, you know, it's a fragile state that we're in at the moment, in terms of, you know, how vulnerable it is to sort of an external shock. I mean, if there was another financial crisis, for instance, I would really worry about the capacity of the major economies to respond in a manner as responsible as they did in 2008-09, right? So we're sort of riding our luck here a little bit until we figure it all out and sort of come back to some sort of consensus politics.
Well, I hesitate to cite anybody else's polling of public attitudes at the Lowy Institute because you guys do so much great work in that regard. But the Chicago Council on Global Affairs does an annual... thank you. I'm on their board. They do an annual survey of American public attitudes. And we've just gone through the data of this last year's. And it does actually portend, hopefully, for what Tom was saying, which is that what it looks like... So first the data, which is that on four central issues on which President Trump had campaigned, immigration, trade, America's role in the world, and alliances. On all four of those issues, this year's Chicago Council survey recorded 15-point positive increases in American support for immigration, in American belief that trade is good for the economy and creates jobs, in support for an America engaged institutionally in the international order, and support for America's alliance relationships. On all four of those issues, you had huge swings in public attitudes in opposition to the president's views. And what we think is happening is that, as Tom rightly suggested, the crisis of the liberal order is causing people to ask really fundamental questions about our economy, about our role in the world, about our societies. But in fact, the good news of the liberal order is that people stop and think about it, they educate themselves about it, and have, at least in the Chicago Council survey, have made a different set of choices than the populist raising of these issues suggested that they would.
I wanted to talk, you mentioned earlier, Corey, about the success of America's China policy or Asia policy. Does the Trump administration have an Asia policy? Maybe starting with Tom and coming back to you, Corey.
Well, I mean, the problem with the Trump administration's Asia policy to start out with is that there are probably about 10 or 12 really excellent Republican Asia experts, and almost all of them have not joined the administration because they've been excluded. Some of them may join in the next few months, but lots of them have been blacklisted because they oppose Trump in the primary. And that's a big problem, you know, because you sort of need those people to devise and execute a really good Asia strategy. And so, you know, there are good civil servants, there are good foreign service officers, there are good, you know, people in the Pentagon on career side on this. And, of course, the generals who've been appointed, some of them have a good sort of sense for Asia politics. But I think there is for Asia strategy, but there is a capacity issue that's there. So that's one issue. And the second thing is they really haven't figured out their attitude toward China, you know, at all. The president's instincts, I think, are very visceral on sort of the economic warfare with China. He would like to wage an economic war with China. He believes that China's been eating America's lunch for a long time. That is very little support in the broader sort of economic policymaking community. Bannon's leaving makes that probably a little less likely, but it's still a big sort of elephant in the room there. And of course, he's also has this visceral opposition to trade with allies as well. He's opposed every trade deal in his lifetime, including TPP. As against that, they've been engaging on the military side, and Mattis has been out, and Pence has been out, and Tillerson has been out, so that's been positive. But I think that they are still very much in that troubled sort of phase, and I think they need to get a team in place quickly. There's a Korea crisis basically with no ambassador to Korea and no assistant secretary for East Asia Pacific Affairs, which is almost unimaginable. And then on the trade side, they need to figure out something. So I wouldn't say the game is up. I think they have a decent shot at it, but they need to get moving.
So here I'm going to be a lot more negative than Tom, since I'm one of the snotty Republicans who signed the Never Trump letters, which is no, they don't have a strategy for Asia. They don't even have the building blocks for thinking of a strategy in Asia. What they managed to do was pick the two least propitious issues and make them the lodestars of our Asia strategy: trade with China and the North Korean nuclear program. Right? Like, writing off TPP as, the starting gun of the administration was one of those erratic, self-indulgent things the president did, and which, for all the smart people surrounding him, nobody had the ability to explain to him that this is good for the American economy and cements our alliance relationships in the most dynamic region in the world. So I am a lot less confident than Tom that they're even going to get it right, because their instincts have actually been really bad, right? Like, why make North Korea such a big issue if you don't have an answer to the problem?
I agree, by the way, completely on the North Korea thing. I mean, Trump, I think, was headed, and maybe still headed, to having a North Korea-centric Asia strategy, which I think is an enormous mistake. Just not to say that it's not a big problem, but by basically making it more important than everything else, it gives China a lot of leverage, and it crowds out sort of everything else. And there is no solution. They don't have a solution to it, and so why elevate it?
Message it, right? The phone call with the president of Philippines, the footsies he's playing about authoritarianism with China, like, the signaling is actually going to get in the way of policy if they don't stop talking.
But there doesn't need to be much policy, so there's nothing to get in the way of. A broader question, though, about America and Asia. There was a lot of debate about the Obama administration's pivot or rebalance to Asia. You know, was it real? How much did it actually happen? But it always struck me that a bigger question was, how much do Americans see Asia as important to them? Beyond just a place to do business. How prepared are Americans to sacrifice blood and treasure for security in Asia? Are there issues? It's very easy, in the Middle East to talk about terrorism, and even with, the evolution of American attitudes toward the Middle East and towards fighting wars there, it's relatively easier to make a case why this matters to you because of terrorism. But how do Americans see Asia in terms of American interests, in terms of American values, in terms of what's important to America? Isn't it going to be difficult for any administration, whether it's a Trump administration or a different administration, to make the case for why America should play a central role in Asia?
No, I view it almost the opposite way, which is, if you think about what the United States has been willing to sacrifice in the Middle East, think about Asia as a place where we actually like our allies in Asia. We actually view you as sharing our values as well as sharing our interests. And I don't think it would be difficult at all to persuade my mom to risk her children and her grandchildren on protecting Japan, Korea, Australia, and other countries that we like in the region.
I agree with that. And I would just add that I don't think you need mass mobilization behind an Asia strategy, actually, because if you look at one of the good things after the Cold War was that all the infrastructure is already in place, right? The alliances are already in place. The force posture in the region is already in place. So there is no heavy lift required in Congress to get an incredibly difficult vote passed, with the exception of the trade stuff. But on the security side, you know, the architecture is already there. And so there doesn't need to be this massive public debate. And in fact, if you have a public debate, it can be counterproductive. So I'll just point you toward the North Korea debate at the moment, which is becoming a bit public. And what we find when you have a major sort of national debate in that is that it's not necessarily the Asia strategists who are making the most influential commentaries on it. It's Sean Hannity or it's Rachel Maddow or it's some, you know, it becomes like the Middle East where everyone has an opinion and there's lots of misrepresentation. Yeah. And so one of the good things about US-Asia strategy, I think, is it has been a little bit beneath the radar, and I think that's a good thing. And the other thing is that there's I don't think it's a question about being willing to go to war or not. I think clearly if Australia, Korea, Japan are fundamentally threatened, absolutely that the alliance will be made good on immediately. But most of what we're talking about is a lot of stuff short of that. It's diplomatic, political, economic, and non-kinetic military, you know, exercises and reassurance and deepening of alliances and partnerships. And all of that, I think, has widespread support in the Congress. And to the extent that people think about it, it's popular in the public as well.
Okay, but if we are such likable allies of America in this region, if it's easier for Americans to sacrifice blood and treasure on Asia than it is elsewhere, why was it so difficult to pass the TPP? Why was it that both candidates at the last presidential election said, we are not prepared to do this for Asia?
So, yes, it is an important point that both presidential candidates were talking complete nonsense about trade policy. And what the Clinton camp, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, since you were actually in it, what the Clinton camp was signaling to everybody was, yes, she's talking nonsense, but once she's elected, she'll do the right thing on this. Whereas Trump was talking nonsense and had no intention of doing the right thing on it. And I think we are struggling our way through a basic education about economics in the United States right now. That's partly the function of the 2008 financial crisis, right? People are actually really angry that bankers are the ones who suffered least when bankers caused this problem. And so, you know, it's sifting its way through its politics. But the bigger, more important trend, you know, if you look at American job losses since 2000, only 15% of them are the result of trade. 85% of them are the result of innovation and automation. And so we are in the midst of a revolution, and somebody who's a truck driver, it's not just that her job is going to go away, her profession's going away. And people understand that, they sense the change that's coming, and none of our politicians are speaking to the fact, not President Obama, not the current candidate, not the candidates this last round, and certainly not the president now, are giving people a vision of the fact that when you have these revolutions, work doesn't go away. New work grows up around it. And if you think about the Industrial Revolution, for example, and the new work that grows up is easier and better paying than the work was before. But we are in the midst of the adaptation. People are scared, and nobody's giving them a positive sense of the future. The politicians who can figure out how to talk to that truck driver are going to own the next three American political elections. But neither party has yet figured out the answer to that.
Yeah, again, I agree with what Corey said. I would add that just two points. One, I think foreign policy people have to share some of the blame on the failure of TPP because basically, we were in favor of it regardless of what was in it, right? We didn't know what was in it, but we knew that we were in favor of it because it was a trade deal and trade deals are good. And the argument we would make would be it's a strategy issue, it's the future of the U.S. and Asia. And it turns out people didn't really care about that, right? They cared about the details. And the opponents of it knew the details and they sort of mastered the negative side of it, whereas we were just sort of waiting for the white smoke and what the deal was and then making a broader argument. And I think we need to get better. The people who are advocating in favor need to get better of understanding those details and explaining why those details are a positive. The second thing is that if you look at the amount of effort placed on TPP, which is basically, you know, about market access and harmonization of regulation, that is not really what's really driving people's anxieties about the global economy, right? They're not sitting around dinner tables saying, boy, I wish we had more market access to Japan. But they are saying, you know, worrying about the technology revolution. Maybe they worry about IP theft from China. Maybe they worry about a new financial crisis or just some of the pressures on the global economy. And we need to think, I think, about the economic diplomacy that we conduct actually addressing what people are most worried about in the global economy and not just focusing. I mean, TTIP is actually even more striking example. Very free economy already between Europe and the United States, and we're concentrating on these tiny, tiny margins of improving access that in a zone that's already very, very free. Maybe we should spend a little bit more time on thinking about those big sort of fault lines in the global economy, and is there a sort of cooperation that could take place between the major sort of democratic economies about address these, whether it's, you know, corporate tax avoidance or IP theft or any of those sort of, or the automation revolution that Corey was talking about.
I've got a dozen other questions, but it's time to give the audience an opportunity to ask some. And maybe I'll sneak a few in between. So please, if you have a question for either Corey or Tom, raise your hand. Wait for the microphone and tell us who you are. Down the front here.
It seems to me that one of the elephants in the room we haven't touched on, I did arrive late, so you may have touched on this in the first 5 minutes, so forgive me if you have, is climate change and the retreat from the Paris Agreement. We are, every generation thinks we're the first ones where things really have changed. And the consensus is new. The solutions are different. We've cracked inflation. We've cracked recession. We've cracked economic cycles. No one's ever faced a challenge of climate change like this generation. That's a big overarching elephant in the room. And I think the consensus around neoliberal economics is collapsing under the weight of the inequality it produces. That's often given as the reason for the change in political dynamics around the world. How do those two conflate in the Trump policy? What is the response to climate change other than a willful denial? And how will that play out?
So I think the answer to that is actually already really clear, right? 23 governors have said that they will abide by the United States' Paris climate agreements. Every major big city mayor has said so. Practically all of the virtue signaling tech titans have said so. That I think what it shows is that American society is taking the challenge a lot more seriously than the federal government is taking the challenge. And fortunately for the country and the planet, the American system of government gives a whole lot of latitude to the great state of California, which, after all, is the world's fifth largest economy, to set and maintain those standards irrespective of what the federal government does. So that would, that's how I think the answer is coming.
I think that the big mistake that Trump made was to pull out of the agreement, but I do think the agreement was flawed, right? I mean, the agreement was non-binding. Some of the research on this recently shows that most countries aren't actually in a position to deliver on their commitments that they made at Paris. So there's a big question about whether it will be enough. But I think what was incumbent on the Trump administration and any government is just to show that they're serious about it and they actually want to try to deal with it. And he basically demonstrated that he wasn't interested at all. And so he pulled out of an agreement that actually was not binding on the United States, that he had no obligation. He could have just changed it from within. Now, that's actually a flaw in the agreement, right? But he could have done that had he so chosen. But he wanted to send a message that he was rejecting it, even though it wasn't binding. And I think that was what offended so many people. But there, the agreement was an attempt to improve on Kyoto because Kyoto was flawed in lots of different ways. But it's so flexible that I think when we get to whenever those deliverable dates are, we'll find that most countries haven't actually lived up to their commitments under it.
Okay.
Thank you. A question about China, and I think you were saying that because China is an authoritarian country, it would run into difficulties in seeking success and further economic development. The Communist Party, I think, has a membership of 30 million in China, and I remember an Economist publication, which I think it was called What China Thinks, which was talking about the amount of discussion that goes on within the Communist Party. And I wonder whether you think that that to a substantial degree can make up for the fact that, it is an authoritarian state.
No, I don't think the views of the Communist Party leadership are a proxy for the views of Chinese, if that was your question. It seemed
within the Communist Party, although there were many controls on freedom of expression and so on for China as a whole, is it different within the Communist Party itself? And is there, in fact, quite a rising debate on big issues within the party? My only view for saying that, as I say, is this Economist publication that seems to describe numbers of little institutes or bodies within the party which serve that purpose.
So I am not a China expert, so I'm not ideally situated to adjudicate whether there is a debate among different approaches within the party. But I will tell you that I'm profoundly skeptical that the people that the authoritarian leadership of the country chooses to allow to hold political office are likely to be an accurate representation of mothers whose babies die from unsafe baby milk and parents grieving over collapsed schools because Communist Party functionaries didn't seek to develop building codes that would protect children in an earthquake. I actually think that's the biggest challenge the Chinese government has. And whether they can, I think the anti-corruption campaign that Xi has put in place is the proof of that, right? If they didn't have to be afraid of the public reaction to what the Communist Party is talking about, they wouldn't be moving so aggressively to try and shore up the legitimacy of the Communist Party with the anti-corruption campaign.
The other thing I think is that, I agree that it isn't the case that it's reflective of, that there's a debate happening that's a proxy for more democratic debate overall. But if it was ever true, it's less true today than ever before. Right, because what's happened over the last 5 years is the consolidation of power within the Chinese Communist Party by Xi Jinping, and it's the use of this anti-corruption campaign to go after his political opponents and to eliminate them one by one. And we're going to find out in the 19th Party Congress soon exactly what that looks like, and when he stays in power rather than relinquishing power, I think we'll know that we're in a very different system. So I don't even think there's a debate anymore, a free debate within the Communist Party. I think it is essentially Xi Jinping's show. And what we're seeing with him, with Putin, with Erdogan, we're seeing the return of strongmen, sort of authoritarian regimes, and we're seeing the movement of authoritarian regimes to dictatorships. And that's where we are. And I think that's, I think that's why we're seeing some of these things we were talking about earlier with this clampdown on freedom of the press and this paranoia in Beijing and elsewhere about the external world and a reaction that's really out of step even with what they would have done in the past.
I was interested in the discussion around Asia foreign policy, and I wonder if, looking back to the Obama administration, could that administration have moved faster to lock in some of the gains from the pivot to Asia? Will the Trump administration continue that in any way? Obviously, they haven't done with TPP. And then again, looking back to the Obama administration, what held them back from completing what they intended to do with the pivot?
Yes.
Just a couple of quick things. I mean, one, I think the President Obama made a major mistake by not selling TPP earlier. You know, he waited till the end. He thought that it would get through in the last year and the politics turned completely toxic, but he never really sold it. That was one major mistake. Second thing was in the first term, he had a pretty good team on Asia. In the second term, he chose people, particularly at the cabinet level, without any consideration of what they were actually interested in. So he chose, you know, John Kerry as Secretary of State, somebody who, you know, you may think is good or bad, but he certainly had no real interest in Asia. He was mainly interested in the Middle East. And so if your legacy is Asia and you want to rebalance from the Middle East to Asia, then why choose a Secretary of State who's obsessed by the Israel-Palestine peace process, right? That may be a good thing, but if you want to move to Asia, then it's not such a great choice. And the same thing was made at the National Security Advisor decision. And so I think they had an opportunity at the end of the first term, and I think they slightly sort of squandered it in the second term. And I think the failure to sell TPP early, I think, was maybe the most consequential mistake in Asia policy that they made.
Yeah, so I do resent that the cacophony of foreign policy in the Trump administration has made Obama foreign policy look better than it deserves to look. TPP should have been done much earlier, so he didn't hand Congress the keys to the car in an election season. The so-called pivot to Asia was a lot less pivot than it ought to have been. And what I think the Trump administration is likely to do, Asia is the place where I do think they are militarizing the policy in a way that's probably unhelpful, that the heavy emphasis on the North Korea problem has in part driven that. The understandable emphasis on pushing back on China about freedom of navigation and the construction of islands, that's one of the huge failures of the Obama administration, that they emphasized a pivot to Asia and then let China get away with changing the rules in the South China Sea. They're trying to push back on that. I think that's a difference in the policy. I think they, one other thing I think they are doing well is pulling allies, particularly Japan and Korea, into closer cooperation with each other. That's a hard thing to do, as you know, with the Japanese and Koreans, but also bringing the Indians into the cooperative framework for Asia. I think that has the potential to be a big improvement. Started under the Bush administration, continued under Obama, they're accelerating it in the Trump administration. If they would only widen this to have, you know, political elements, that would also be extremely helpful.
Corey, I want to pick up on that. You mentioned about this heavy military emphasis in terms of policy in Asia. We now have an administration that has no shortage of generals in it, in the Secretary of Defense, the Chief of Staff, National Security Advisor, and we also have a State Department that seems very weak and unloved. Is that a problem for the administration to have so many heavy-duty military figures? Perhaps adding coherence to the administration, but is it a problem in terms of foreign policy making?
I think it is. It may be a problem. It is one of the least of their problems, though, for a couple of reasons. First, that the specific individuals you're talking about are people who are really thoughtful and serious and have spent a lot of time and effort becoming superb strategists, by which I mean Jim Mattis, H.R. McMaster, and John Kelly. The second thing I would say is that it's important to make a distinction between active duty military officers and veterans, right? And in the particular case of the Secretary of Defense, we have, for very good reason, very seldom permitted a military officer within 7 years of their retirement from holding that powerful position. An exception was made for Jim, And in my judgment, a reasonable exception was made. But one of the things that we found, I should have said since you mentioned the book at the start, that we did the biggest survey of American public attitudes about military issues that had been done in 15 years. Because we wanted to see how 15 years at war might have changed American public attitudes about our military. And the thing that was most striking in the data is that across the last 25 years, American trust in our elected public officials has plummeted, while American confidence and support in our military has remained very, very high. And it's the discordance between those two things that has caused an increasing phenomenon of the suits hiding behind the uniforms on things, right? So I think President Trump, because people had so little confidence in him, that incentivized him to choose prominent veterans for cabinet positions. But President Trump didn't nominate any more retired generals for jobs in his administration than President Obama did. They actually had the same number, right? Rick Shinseki, the former chief of staff of the Army, was the head of Veterans Affairs. Jim Jones, the former commandant of the Marine Corps, was the national security advisor, right? So it's not just a Trump phenomenon. It's that the public lacks confidence in our elected political leaders, and they have confidence in the military. And therefore, we are seeing an increasing incentivization on for politicians to let the military make the case for the wars we're fighting. If you notice, a grace note of how the Secretary of Defense has done his job, and I think because he's quite conscious of these issues, is that the president delegated to Secretary Mattis authority to set troop levels in Afghanistan. And he declined to use that authority until the president invested in choosing a strategy for Afghanistan and sold it to the American people, because the president was, in my judgment, trying to avoid responsibility for the setting of strategy and the outcome of the war. And the Secretary of Defense looks to me smart enough to have trapped him into having to take that responsibility. And that's frankly good for the Republic.
Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I do think it's a problem for a few reasons. One is that I think it's unhealthy that people basically are turning to the generals to save us, quote unquote, which is a pretty common sort of theme in the debate. I think the generals in this are generally on the right side of the debate, because people are worried about the president being erratic and volatile and potentially dangerous. But I don't think it's a healthy thing that it's the military that's seen as sort of the savior in it, even though I agree with that sentiment. I mean, I too sort of see Secretary Mattis in particular as a really important sort of piece of preventing this administration from going completely off the rails. I mean, I think people feel a lot more confident in the administration because he is there, and I think that is why he had overwhelming support for the waiver at the beginning, because people trusted him and they thought it was very important to have someone in that position. I mean, imagine if Rudy Giuliani was Secretary of Defense right now, right? I mean, I think we will be a lot more worried. And Newt Gingrich was Secretary of State, and, you know, John Bolton was National Security Advisor. I mean, we will be, I think, at a much greater risk of a crisis, but because people rightly trust these people in those positions, I think the danger is less. But overall, I think it's not particularly healthy. The other point I just make is that President Trump has a unique disrespect, I think, for civilian foreign policy expertise. He basically believes that there are two types of people who he trusts. One are generals, and interestingly, generals, not necessarily admirals, but military, senior military officers. And the second are really, really wealthy people like Rex Tillerson, because he thinks both of those have succeeded in life, right? They've sort of done something that's sort of, you know, there are metrics there that are objective that they have won, like he has won. And he doesn't sort of trust anyone else. And I think there's a lot of expertise that will be very beneficial to him on the civilian side. But I don't think he really has any intention of listening to them. And so I think that's very unfortunate. So it is on these former military officers, and in H.R. McMaster's case, a serving officer, to fill that gap. But it's not their job. It shouldn't be their job to sort of have to fill that. I mean, they have a very important role to play But there is a system there. And the very final point is, you know, a lot of this, a lot of strategy is not just military, it's economic, it's political. All of that expertise has been sidelined. You know, who's going to devise the...
I don't think that's fair.
Well, I'm just, who's going to devise the successor to TPP in the Asia Pacific? I mean, there were people who can do that, right? But they've been sort of marginalized by the president. So I'm very supportive of the choices he made from the military side, but I just think that it's reflective of a broader problem in terms of how he looks, how Trump looks at his job, that he's only looked at those people and excluded all the other people.
Imagine not trusting foreign policy wonks. We've got time for one more question, just here.
Thank you. Anthony Zwi, University of New South Wales. Neither of you has mentioned Europe at all. And I was wondering whether you could...
We've only got an hour.
...say something, because certainly in the last, you know, since the Trump presidency, the distancing of the US from Europe and Europe, at least, let's say, France and Germany, in terms of stating policies in relation to trade, refugees, climate change, development aid, human rights, engagement with Africa, seem quite far away from... what previously would have been aligned policies between Europe and the US. So I was wondering if you could say something about where Europe sort of fits in, especially when you're talking about the two sort of hegemonic powers on either side, the US and China.
So I am less confident than you that... that Europe and the United States policies naturally align on all of the issues that you mentioned. I think under any Republican administration, they wouldn't have aligned nearly as carefully, right? If you just look at approval ratings that Democratic presidents get from European publics, I think there is a natural, a more natural connection to the left of the American political spectrum than to the right of the American political spectrum. But I do think President Trump's particular behaviors have aggravated that in ways that are unhelpful to American politics, to American foreign policy. It's been interesting to watch the different attitudes that the different European leaders have taken, though, right? So Angela Merkel took the scold the president publicly and be the clarion of values approach, which is smart for her domestic politics with an election coming in the fall, especially since the left was going to try and push her into looking like she was supporting the president. But it's not a particularly good strategy if she should need any cooperation from the American government in the next 4 years. The French president, Macron, has taken a fascinating dual-track approach of, on the one hand, you know, grandstanding, you know, the Paris Climate Accords and himself as the embodiment of international leadership, but on the other hand, being quite hand-holdy cozy with President Trump, inviting him to the Bastille Day, which has so far worked. Right? The French president is much more likely to get anything he wants out of the Trump administration than the much more important American ally sitting in Berlin is likely to. I think all of the Europe piece is also unsettled by President Trump's profoundly compromised policies towards Russia. And I think that's just going to make a big mess of a lot of this going forward. He seems to be hurting the British Prime Minister to the extent you can tell. It's a make the rubble bounce level of damage because she's already gotten herself quite in enough trouble. But the hand-holding picture of the two of them and the suggestion of servility on her part to him, I think, has actually been domestically bad for her. So I think it's going to be a very complicated mosaic for the entirety of the Trump administration, in part because these are not his people, right? These are not politicians he likes, he's going to get along with. There's the Russia problem. He seems to think nobody else has domestic politics but us.
Yeah, so I think if we look at the three major sort of regions of strategic importance, Middle East, Asia, and Europe, it's clear that the one Trump cares about the least is Europe, right? I mean, he cares about the Middle East because he sort of likes the reception he gets there. He's sort of been seduced to a degree by the Sunni Arab states. He had a good relationship with Abe at the beginning, good meetings with Xi Jinping. But he really, I think, doesn't really care about Europe at all. Like, he has no sense of the history of why the United States is in Europe. He doesn't really like the European leaders. He has this very compromised position with the Russians. And so I think the recipe for disaster in Europe is very, very high. And certainly, from what we can tell, in private, he would very much sort of reinforce that very anti-NATO, very anti-European. What I think has happened, though, over the last 7 months is that precisely because that was so obvious, Secretary Mattis and others have worked very, very hard to try to bolster the alliances, particularly NATO, and they've had some degree of success in that. We're at a very uneven road into it. Trump, you'll remember, in that big speech in Brussels, was meant to publicly express support for Article 5 and did not do so. And it really was a close to a catastrophe. But then he reversed himself because of the level of criticism that he got a few weeks later with the Romanian president visiting and then on his trip to Poland. And so that's progress, I think, because he is actually in a more normal position in Europe now than he was at the beginning. But it wasn't a surefire thing at all. I mean, it was something people worked really, really hard on. I disagree a little bit with Corey on Merkel. She has said those things, I think, as part of the political campaign in Germany. But overall, she's been fairly constructive with the Trump administration. She had a pretty good meeting with him. She really tried to engage. They worked very hard on the Ivanka angle, and they basically brought her out and praised her. And it's amazing how easy Trump is to manipulate, because Trump turned around and said, oh, Merkel loves Ivanka and all the great work she's doing, and that made a big difference. But they were clever to do that, and they've basically been engaging. And the reason they've been engaging and Macron's been engaging is because they're petrified, right? When you are, when you're just annoyed, when Europeans were dealing with Bush, they always knew the alliance was solid, but they didn't really like Bush, so they criticized him, they called him a warmonger, they used protests. But when you're really, really, really worried about someone, you say, you're doing great, you know, don't change anything, we love you. And that's essentially what they're doing with Trump. Right, they're sort of praising him, they're being nice to him, Macron invited him over, they're working for ways to sort of deal with him. They're trying not to sort of have a fundamental breach in any real way, and it's because they're incredibly sensitive to the fact that he could very well break with them over security and economic issues, and they're determined not to do that. And one final thing just on Russia. The Russia thing has been really interesting. I mean, we all know that Trump has always had very good things to say about Putin. I think he has been determined to try to have a partnership with the Russians despite everything, but he has been thwarted from doing so by Congress and by the American people and by Bob Mueller. And so he wanted to have an early summit in Reykjavik, and that was vetoed. He wanted to lift sanctions. They weren't able to do so. He had to sign these sanctions. He complained bitterly about it, but they're now in place. He put Rex Tillerson in charge of basically a reset 2.0 with the Russians, but essentially a failed party because Putin overstepped the mark, I think, in some of the meetings in terms of who he was trying to get. And so we don't really know where this is going to go. I think there's a very substantial chance that Putin will turn on Trump in a really significant way because he can't get that much from him because Trump can't deliver it. So he may want to sort of test him as an adversary, believing that he's not really committed to some of the things that his predecessor was. So I think Europe is still very fraught, and there's a lot of things to watch there. But I would acknowledge that there's been some improvement, partly because of the work of the cabinet and others on Trump's attitude to European security. So I'm not quite as sort of pessimistic as I might have been 6 months ago because of the success that those people have had.
Ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, we're going to have to bring things to a close.
May I, as we bring things to a close, on behalf of Tom and me, give a special thanks to a friend of Lowy, Andrew Shearer, who brought us here to Sydney and gave us a couple of extraordinary days of engagement with Australian colleagues. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you for loaning us. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've had it's been a real privilege this evening to listen to such insightful analysts of American politics and of global politics. I'm grateful to Andrew, to CSIS for loaning these two to us for an evening.
Thank you for having us.
No, it's my pleasure. Please join me again in thanking Corey and Tom. And we'll see you all next time.